Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast that spotlights women in Baltimore. Liz Cornish's relationship to biking started out of convenience, but now it's at the center of her work. Liz is the executive director of BikeMore, an advocacy organization that works to improve bicycle infrastructure, policies, and awareness in Baltimore. Before coming to Baltimore, Liz was somewhat of a professional adventurer, and most recently, the first women bike manager at the League of American Bicyclists. Liz talked about what that means, as well as the ways biking has informed her feminism. Liz touched on her somewhat unexpected path to bike advocacy and how her upbringing informed her current work around neighborhoods. We also discussed addressing Baltimore's disparities in access to biking, why biking is so polarizing, and learning to take up space. Here's our conversation. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I've had the good fortune throughout my early part of my career traveling the country, and I've gotten to live and experience both coasts and a lot of places in between. And I moved to Baltimore in 2015 to be the executive director of BikeMore. So I've been here, it'll be 2 years this May, and it's been really nice to finally feel like I've landed where someplace that I can put down roots and call home for a long time. So I bought my first home this last year, and I'm trying to think of like what else is sort of the little bit about me.
It's a hard question to answer sometimes.
That's the littlest bit. I would say the other thing that I always like to tell people is that I have a 100-pound dog named Daisy.
Oh my gosh.
That has been to many of the places that I've lived. She's 7, so she's been with me for the last 7 years, and that's included, I think, 8 different addresses and 7 different cities. So
what's Tulsa, Oklahoma like, and what was your childhood like growing up there?
So I always like to talk about how I grew up and where I grew up, because I think it really, interestingly enough, not planned, but it has come full circle into the work that I'm doing now here in Baltimore. So my parents were hippies in the 60s. My dad was a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War. My mom was a music teacher in the early part of her life and then a stay-at-home mom. By the time I came around, I'm the youngest of 3. The neighborhood where we lived in Tulsa was a predominantly Black neighborhood. And my family is pretty socially liberal. And in my mind, and we were raised Catholic. And so I think it was a different era of the Catholic Church that my parents were a part of that definitely was pretty socially conscious in relationship to how our faith oriented towards service to others and how we sort of viewed the world. And my dad is a lawyer, and he just felt like he wanted to make sure that his kids had an opportunity to get to know lots of different types of people. And so I think that informed where we grew up, and it informed the schools that I went to. I went to magnet schools. So I went to schools named George Washington Carver Middle School and Booker T. Washington High School. And these were schools that were historically Black schools. And then when forced busing became a thing, the magnet programs were created as an alternative to forced busing. And my parents, my sister's 10 years older, were one of the first families to help sort of start the magnet program and start their children as part of the magnet program in Tulsa. And Tulsa is still to this day very segregated. It is the home of Greenwood Avenue, which is Black Wall Street. It was typified as the largest race riot in America in the 20s, which really wasn't a race riot at all. It was a lot of white members burning down some of the most highly concentrated areas of Black wealth in the country in the 1920s. So I think the racial history of how cities are designed and where people live was a huge part of my upbringing, being one of the only white families in the neighborhood. But the story that I like to tell about what Tulsa was like that helped sort of create the basis for my work today was that I lived in this 70s subdivision called Gilcrease Hills, and there's probably maybe like 5 model homes that are in the subdivision. So as a kid, it's a lot of cul-de-sacs, and we rode bikes everywhere and played in the woods behind people's houses. And you would ride your bikes to somebody's house, and you would run in to grab a drink of water or to sit down and eat a snack. And so as a kid, I would go in and out of neighborhood family homes, and you'd meet people's parents and you'd hang out. And I think what was really interesting was that you started to learn like which houses on which blocks were just like yours, you know, in terms of the layout and design. And now being able to reflect on that, I didn't think about it much as a kid, obviously, but being able to reflect on that, I think this exposure to Black family life as a child and to be able to have entry into the intimacy that is sitting down at somebody's kitchen table and having a meal as a family, and then being able to see the layout of a home that is exactly like yours and to know that a Black family lives there. I think that coupled with the fact that because of my dad's involvement with the Catholic Church, one of his really close friends was a guy by the name of Dan Hawkins, and his wife, Edna, who are Black, were my godparents. And so Dan and Edna were central to my upbringing. Dan was always around and always there for me when my parents weren't able to be. And as such, I got toted around to a lot of his family gatherings as well. And so I think when I started doing work related to neighborhoods and related to improving the quality of life of where people live and understanding that it's impossible to start to talk about these issues without also talking about the intersections of race and socioeconomic factors that lead our neighborhoods to be one way or another. I think it was those early experiences of growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the way that I did, going to the schools that I did, where Black family life and Black children were celebrated and revered. And it was such a, it was so normalized. And then getting to grow up and getting to travel all across the country and realize how unique that experience was in my formative years. And that I felt, as I became more called to the work that I do now, that it was important for me to talk about that exposure that I had as a kid, and why I feel like it's a gift that I have a responsibility to help sort of inform my work so that other people that did not have that experience understand that there are things that divide us that we create in our minds, and there are things that are built that divide us that we've created, and that there are ways and there are paths forward to undoing those divides. And I got to live in them for a period of time.
Did you notice that segregation when you were young?
Absolutely. I mean, when my parents, there was a brief couple of years where we moved neighborhoods, and I ended up having to go to a school for 3 years that wasn't a magnet school, and that I was one of maybe only 10 white kids in a K-8 school. And the race was just acknowledged and it was recognized. And then later in middle school and high school, when I took the bus, I was probably the only white kid, you know, one of two white kids maybe on a bus. And I think, you know, anytime when you're, I think the thing that people forget, when you are different or when you're another, and sometimes, and for me at different points in time, that was being the white kid or the white girl. It's natural for adolescents to bully or to pick on or to, you know, make that situation difficult. But I think I always knew that that was, that the conversation around race that was happening around me, that I was just kind of a speck in this broader, bigger conversation that was happening, and that the flip side of that were the friendships and the relationships that I've sustained today and that I've been able to make moving forward, where people have been generous in terms of allowing me into their families and into their lives, that has shown me that maybe the fact that I was raised the way I raised gives me both an awareness, but then also a comfort of navigating different situations that I think maybe some people that grew up that didn't have access to Black family life don't have.
What brought you across the country and led to all of your traveling?
So when I graduated high school, I really didn't want to go to college. I really struggled in school to be interested in school. And the idea of having to sign up and pay for more school really didn't agree with my sensibilities at the time. But my family fought me on that. And I ended up applying to one school and ended up at a very tiny school in Arkansas called Hendricks College. And it was a really good school, but it wasn't a good fit. And I remember as a kid, I was an artist. I painted and I drew. And I was like, okay, I'm going to art school. And long story short, I applied to the Chicago Art Institute, went to this thing called immediate decision option, which is for transfer students where you just show up with your portfolio and they accept you or don't accept you right there on the spot. It's a big risk. And I did it and I got accepted. And I remember sitting in my dorm room back in Arkansas that spring. And as, you know, people are wont to do when they're 19, I became a puddle of tears, of stress and just indecision of like, who am I and what do I want to be? And the other thing that had been running throughout my life constantly, in addition to art, is that I spent every summer at summer camp. I loved it there, and I loved playing outside, and I loved the opportunities that I had to both physically push myself and learn new skills and lead others. So I sort of had these two interests, and in my head they were competing, and I just said, which is funny now that I live in Baltimore, which I feel like is steeped to the gills with art kids or former art kids that are now art adults, that I love and I cherish, and it's something that I that drew me to Baltimore and that I think continues to inspire me to be here. But at the time, I said, I don't want to go to school with a bunch of art kids. And I don't know if that's me. And so I, at the very last minute in May, I applied to a tiny school in Arizona called Prescott College. It has 500 students. There were no dorms. There's no grades. A lot of the classes are field-based. And I moved there without ever visiting that fall. And I enrolled. And I got a degree in adventure education.
Wow.
And so I took classes like sea kayaking and marine landscapes and rock climbing and geology. And I traveled all throughout the Southwest. The first thing you do when you go to Prescott College is you go on a 21-day backpacking trip. I had never backpacked a day in my life. It was the most physically grueling thing I've ever done. And I remember at one point not finding water for like 2 days. So we had to do this thing called dry camping, where you just carry, like you knew where the next water was going to be. So you just fill up dromedaries, which are really heavy, which make your backpack really heavy. And you just carry all the water you need to drink, but you can't use any water for cooking. There's just not enough. So you're just eating cheese and crackers and you're eating dry cereal. And I remember on the second day feeling so hot and so thirsty and thinking this was the hardest thing I'd ever done or the most like discomfort I'd ever felt. And I remember my instructor being like, yeah, but like, you're going to get through it. And then like the very next thing that we did was end up at a resupply where we were swimming in Parson Springs, which is this like, beautiful like swimming hole in the middle of the desert. And we got all this cold, fresh food. And I think so through that work, I traveled a lot as a guide. And so I spent most of my 20s leading trips with kids, mostly kids from cities, out in the woods for days and weeks on end. And it was life-changing work for me and for the people I got to work with. And I got to see some of the best parts of the country. And I got to see people at the best versions of themselves. And it eventually led me to starting to run programs. And so when I graduated grad school, I got a master's in recreation administration. I wanted to be the boss. So I got a boss degree. And I had been living in Washington State. And I had worked for a climbing outfitting company. I had gotten to climb Rainier twice in one summer. And it was sort of this dream living in the middle of the forest, right in the shadow of Mount Rainier, and getting to meet all of these amazing men and women that climb mountains for a living and getting to be around them and their travels and getting to just know that like adventure as a lifestyle was possible. But I was super unhappy and I felt really isolated. And ultimately, while that was somebody's dream job, it wasn't mine. And the next thing that I found myself doing is I was moving to Omaha, Nebraska, and I was running an Outward Bound school. And they had started opening up Outward Bound schools in more cities, just like the one that's here in Baltimore, to make sure that there was an opportunity for kids that didn't have the maybe resources or capacity to go on these 21-day expeditions, you know, out in Colorado. But could there be opportunities to do these shorter courses closer to home that would have the same transformative experience? And so I started the Outward Bound school in Omaha. And it was really my time there, living in another Midwestern segregated city, very much like the place that I grew up, that I started to really, and to spend 4 seasons in a place, which was the first time I had done that in a decade, that I started to really understand the value and the necessity of what I would call neighborhood work and local work. And that really began the sort of part two of my career and sort of put a taper on my time in the outdoor industry and really set me on a path to doing what I do now.
So that phase two, was that something that became clear to you at that time? Like, you know, I'm interested in neighborhoods and neighborhood work, and this is what I'm going to do to accomplish that kind of work? Or did you still kind of feel like you were risk-taking and trying different things and floundering at all at that time?
So a couple of things happened. Yes, I wanted to change careers. I applied for jobs. I didn't get them. I didn't have enough experience. People had me in a box of this outdoorsy woman, you know, and that what did I possibly know about urban planning or design or politics? So it took a while. And I actually ended up during that time, I got married. I took another job in another state doing outdoorsy stuff. I ran the outdoor recreation department at the University of South Carolina in Columbia for another 2 years after that. So it took me one more job, basically, of doing something that I was good at, that I loved, but that wasn't where my heart was, you know, headed and where I felt like my talents needed to be applied. And I remember at one point, maybe 6 months after I took the job, I got a phone call and it was an Omaha area code. So I took it. And I remember stepping outside of my office into the hallway to take the call. And it was a job that I had interviewed with in Omaha, and I was one of the finalists, and they had hired the other person. Well, 6 months later, that other person didn't work out. And so they were calling me to see if I was still interested. I was so mad. I was like, I just moved me and my husband across the country to this place in South Carolina that we didn't love, and we loved Omaha. And now you've changed your mind, and you've realized that the skills that I had or the talents that I brought to the table were actually what you were looking for, which was what I was really trying to tell you. And I ended up actually recommending someone for the job that got it, and I think has thrived and flourished in that position. It's been really fun to watch. But that phone call gave me the confidence to say, you know what, I am hireable in this field, and I'm going to keep applying for jobs. And so I applied. The next job I applied for in this field was at the League of American Bicyclists. So this was a national organization in DC doing bike advocacy. And so I was an outsider. I mean, I didn't have any career experience in this particular role, but I had done a lot of volunteer work and a lot of organizing work. And actually my job at the University of South Carolina positioned me well in terms of bike advocacy. I was running a bike shop for the university, and I was doing a lot of bike master planning for the university as well, and coordinating a lot of different stakeholders to address some of the bike and pedestrian issues that we were having on campus. So in one instance, it was probably the professional step I needed to get the right mix of experience to be competitive for the next job that I got. But I also see it as, in some ways, it was the safe choice as well in terms of the next step that I maybe needed to take to remind myself, no, you're really done with this part of your career and it's time to move on.
At the League of American Bicyclists, you were the first women bike manager, is that correct?
Yeah, so...
What does that mean?
So a very forward-thinking colleague of mine, Carolyn Shapansky, created a program called Women Bike. And so she was the communications director at the League at the time. And what we were looking at, or what, you know, I would say, what bike advocates were looking at was, how do you increase ridership among women? So as this trend in cities was starting to happen, where we saw Americans in general were taking to the bike as transportation at a rate that we hadn't seen in a really long time, and that cities and municipalities were starting to design roadways and develop programs like bike sharing, that was really asking people to mode shift, to say, is it possible that some of the trips that we were taking by car are actually achievable or possible by bike? Well, they are. But the rate at which people were choosing to ride, women only comprised 23% of ridership. So being able to deeply examine the why behind why aren't women riding at the same rates of men, I think is important, because the answers to those questions ultimately help to give the reasoning or the next steps for, like, well, what do we need to do? And how do we need to design things to increase ridership? So my job was sort of twofold. I got to connect with and travel the country, meeting people in cities that were engaging women and doing the work and doing the grassroots organizing and doing the programming that was really inviting women back to bicycling. A lot of times we learn to ride as a kid, and then around 13 or 14, the bike gets put in the garage, and then we never really pick it back up again. Maybe we ride to a couple classes in college, and then we get our first job and we buy a car and we never ride again. Well, these programs were really finding ways to get women to think differently about their transportation choice and give them the confidence and the social support that they might need to choose a different mode of transportation. So my job was to study what's working and also look at trends and examine what was most exciting to me. Why aren't there as many women as men doing bike advocacy work, that are doing transportation policy, that are working within departments of transportation as engineers and planners? So why is there a gender gap at that level as well? Because I think when we look at who's making the decisions about how our streets are designed, we all experience the public space through this lens of our identity. And gender is a part of our identity. And women experience public space inherently different than men. And if more men are designing public space, they're not necessarily always thinking about a woman's experience in that public space. And so I think for me, it's been vitally important to create pathways for leadership, for women to both emerge as running organizations that do the advocacy work, that push lawmakers to consider aspects, you know, about the gender gap in these transportation choices. But then also, what are those other pivot points or lenses of identity of which we experience public space that have led to either inadequate or just maybe ill-informed decisions about how our streets and public spaces are designed? And I would say there's no question that race is another piece of our identity that determines differences in how we experience public space and how public space is designed. And so I think that experience at the League was really transformational in a couple of ways. One, I worked with phenomenally smart women that gave me the confidence to assert my beliefs around feminism, both in my professional life and my personal life, in a way that I just hadn't before. And the other piece was I realized that I had just as many skills and talents in this area as any male colleague, and that even though I didn't have a degree in urban planning, that my ability to quickly read something and get up to speed and synthesize information and contextualize that for the people that I'm trying to persuade to think differently, that was a skill and a talent that I had that made me good at my job and that made me the right person for the job.
When did you learn how to ride a bike?
So I learned how to ride a bike probably, I don't know, maybe when I was 8 or 9 years old. And the first bike I rode was a pink bike with a banana seat that was probably hand-me-down from my sisters. I had the coaster brakes, and my dad taught me how to ride. And I remember in the beginning, every time I would hear a car coming, I would just be terrified and I would peel out into the grass. But, you know, what was interesting is that, and then I upgraded 1 year for Christmas, I got a 10 speed, and that was my bike forever. But I stopped riding right around high school, and I got a car, and I turned 16. And then in college, when I was in Arizona, I got another bike, another pink bicycle. It was a beach cruiser that I got at a flea market, not suitable for the topography of Prescott, Arizona. But I rode it anyway, because parking was a real pain on campus. And so people joke all the time about because of the work I do and that I do ride bikes a lot, but I don't have the same fervent passion for bicycling that I think some people do, where their house is loaded with lots of different bikes and their whole social life and identity is wrapped up in bikes. I really started riding bikes because I hate wasting a minute of my time looking for parking. And I always found it to be this really efficient form of transportation in the places that I've lived. And the cool part about riding a bike for me as an adult was that it really taught me to take up space. And when you're riding a bike, especially in a city that doesn't have very well-developed bike networks or protected bike facilities, you have to mix with traffic. And you have to ride defensively and sometimes aggressively. And I think as women, we're socialized at a very early age to not take risks, especially physical risks. Don't get hurt. You know, you hear that a lot when you're a little girl. Get down from there. Don't get hurt. And we don't see people telling little boys that to the same degree. And then I wonder how that transfers over into the decisions that we make as we get older. And so the career that I chose, the climbing the mountains and the boating the rivers, that flew in the face of that. And so did bike commuting in cities. And I always tell people that that's one of the best sort of carryover effects for women choosing to ride, especially in cities, especially for transportation, is that it really teaches you to take up space. And that has such amazing spillover effect into our everyday lives.
Was that hard or scary in the beginning for you?
Sure. I mean, it's still hard and it's still scary. Like, there's still moments where I have close calls or where I feel shaken all the time. But there's perceived risk and there's actual risk. And that's something that I learned a lot when I was a guide. So the whole point, you know, the whole educational model of something like Outward Bound is that you have people experience perceived risk. Like, they feel like what they're doing is really hard and is really scary. But the guide knows that they've managed a lot of the actual risk. And so that it's actually pretty safe. And when we physically push ourselves in that way, or we mentally get ourselves in a space that's uncomfortable, that expands our opportunity for learning and personal transformation. And so riding a bike in a city has the same effect. We challenge what is possible. So when you first start bike commuting, I think the idea of biking, maybe your ride to work is 5 miles each way. So the idea of biking 10 miles every day seems daunting, maybe even impossible. The idea of figuring out, well, what am I going to wear? Or what if it rains? Or how am I going to get cleaned up for the meeting that I have right after I get to the office? Or where will I park my bike? Or where will I keep my things? So these are all these, like, that's all stuff you have to figure out when you're first learning. And I also think as women, more than men, we choose or oftentimes opt out of experiences where we have to be the novice and where we have to kind of fumble our way through the beginning, because that doesn't look very professional. It definitely messes with our perception or the ideal that this of perfect that we try to maintain, or that we're socialized, that we're taught to maintain. So bike commuting makes it okay to be a beginner. It makes it okay to fumble through in the beginning, because, I mean, you can read online like what to wear or what to think, but at the end of the day, it's going to be your own personal style and your own personal routine and trial and error that's going to dial in your system or your style that makes your commute yours and comfortable and efficient. And you just have to figure that out. And you're going to look silly and you're going to make mistakes at some point in that process. But growing to be more comfortable with being in that learning space, I think, is really critical, because too often as women, we're not taking on certain maybe professional roles or challenges because we don't want to look silly, or we don't want to look like we don't know what we're doing. And we opt out of being in a lot of spaces where we could be really, really effective, and our perspective is so needed. And so I just always tell people that you're smarter than you think, and that you're more capable than you know, and that the most important thing for everyone is for women to be there, to show up and to be there and to be in those decision-making roles. And so time and time again, I've heard story after story of women that bike commuting and making that decision has been transformative in so many other aspects of their life, not just their health or not just the actual how they get to and from work.
And what are some of those ways in your life, and in what ways have you seen that spillover effect of taking up space beyond biking?
I think the most personal one was the decision that I ultimately arrived at, you know, with my ex-husband, was to end our marriage. As I grew as a person, and as I cultivated my own systems of beliefs around feminism, they just weren't compatible with the marriage that I had, which was really sad, because I think the other part of being a human being is you grow up and you want to partner and you want to have a family. So when I wasn't successful at that, that really challenged my self-perception, because I had been really good at work and not really good at marriage. So I think the success, or the, I don't want to say success because that's not the right word, but the learning I did about myself through biking, but most importantly, the relationships I made with other women through biking, were the types of female friendships that you carry with you the rest of your life. They were incredibly supportive at a time when I was so separated from my family. And I couldn't imagine going through a divorce and then 6 months later going through a move to a new city if I wouldn't have had biking and the female friendships that came from biking as a part of that. So I think that's, if nothing else, when people say, well, why should I bike? Because you make a type of friendship and a type of community that I think we really need right now. Like, people need that. And that's one of the many benefits that biking provides. But community is definitely a big part of it.
So is that community kind of built in? Do you feel like, you know, if you were to pick up and move tomorrow to a new city and start biking, that's an instant group of people you can connect with and befriend?
It is. And I think my work has also allowed me to maintain friendships with other people that work in transportation advocacy, specifically bike advocacy, across the country. And so I get windows into what is it like? What is the bike culture like? What is what are different communities like in other cities. And when people are thinking about relocating and they're scared, and I've done this a lot, like I've picked up my stuff and I've gone to a place where I didn't know anyone probably a dozen times in my adult life. And I always tell people, well, if you'd like to make new friends and you want to do it quickly, ride a bike, do a social ride, find where people who bike hang out and drink beer. That's all, you know, get coffee. Like, that's always a really good way to, it is a built-in community. And it's one that increasingly is more incredibly diverse in upbringing and background. And, you know, you have lawyers and you have bike messengers and you have artists and you have all these different people that do different things in their day-to-day lives, but we all ride bikes and we all have this shared experience of what does it feel like to be both vulnerable and independent. And those are two things that I think are experiences that you can have in the same day when you're riding a bike, and that really shape you and that ultimately also bring you closer to the place where you live. And so the perspective and the ability to see things close up, especially what's happening in Baltimore, the ability to get to know people that you see on your daily commute and talk to people because you're not behind a wall of steel and glass in a car. Those interactions, those daily interactions are the building blocks of strong communities. And those are things that people who bike get to experience as part of their daily life. And so it's really hard pressed to find people who bike regularly in a city that don't also love the city where they live. And people live in all sorts of cities with challenges. I mean, Baltimore has its more than its fair share, but the people that I know that bike regularly love Baltimore deeply.
So you got to Baltimore in May of 2015. What surprised you most? And was there anything in this position that you had to unlearn, or expectations about Baltimore or the job that ended up being unfounded?
I think the thing that I am constantly relearning is that no one knows what they're doing to the degree that people want you to believe that they know what they're doing. So we're all learning as we go. And this idea that there's really such thing as an expert or somebody that has it all figured out or understands the exact right thing to do and has all of the knowledge more than someone else, that really doesn't exist, particularly in policy. That there are best practices and that there is research and there is data that points us in the right direction. But then in a lot of times, we are figuring it out as we go. And I think that there is such a disdain to admit that, especially in politics. So that's something that, you know, as a newcomer to Baltimore, I was really sensitive to. I wanted to be humble about not coming across as a know-it-all. And I wanted to be responsive to the community that I was sent here to serve. And I wanted to be learning from people that had lived here longer than me. And I did that. But then there came a time when I realized that the other thing that Baltimore struggles with is a leadership gap. And that too often there are plenty of people that want to weigh in or armchair quarterback some of the decisions that are happening in our city, but there's not enough people willing to put their reputation on the line and say, I have an idea for a solution. Let's act. Let's move forward. Let's get something done. Let's try to make something better. Let's try to initiate progress. That is risky. I also have found that one of my talents is I am less risk averse than other people that do this work. And I also feel like I have a responsibility to be bold, because one, when you're bold, it emboldens others to stand with you. And I've just seen that play out time and time again. When I have felt like it's risky to say what I think about something, but I do it anyway, it doesn't take but a mere moment before there are lots of other smart, capable, talented people that are right beside me saying, yes, that's exactly, I agree. That's exactly what I think too. So we need more people to step up and be bold. And it is sort of the challenge of this work, is that you're going to be scrutinized anytime you stand up, but you have to be willing to keep doing it again and again and again. That's how you win. And our the people that live here deserve to have good stuff happen in their city. And so they deserve advocates that are willing to keep stepping up to the plate so that we can win.
Why is biking so polarizing?
I don't know.
This is someone I don't bike, and I don't have, you know, any vested interest one way or the other. And it always surprises me whenever I read about any kind of biking legislation or advocacy. The vitriol it seems to inspire from both sides can be, I don't know, a lot more than you would expect.
Why is biking so polarizing? It makes absolutely no sense to me. But I think why it continues to be polarizing is that people have learned that it is a great way to get website hits. It is a great way to get your argument to stay in the media cycle for more than 24 hours is if for some way we talk about biking, because we really elicit all types of the work that we do elicits criticism and critique from all type different walks of life and all different political spectrums of people that, you know, in some ways you get called the entitled bicyclist. But in other ways, I push back and say, well, we don't have enough rights or enough space, and we are entitled to that. So what does that mean? I think anytime you start to feel the fire around something that you believe in and it stirs people up, it probably means it's probably a really good indicator that you're hitting on something that is ready to change in our society, and that we may not have a clear solution, or at least one that we've all agreed upon as a next step. And so that discomfort, you know, going back to that concept of discomfort, that discord, that it creates these polarizations, but it is constructed. I mean, it's really not real. When you talk to people, all different types of people, people actually don't hate bicycling. Bicycling in itself, I mean, bicycling is ice cream. I mean, it's fun. It's pretty accessible. It's affordable. It's has this capacity to address a myriad of social issues, public health, cheap access to physical activity, cheap access to transportation and mobility, and community building, and all these different things that it does are all things that people really actually like. You know what also biking does? It reduces traffic congestion. People hate traffic. The thing that unites all of us is most people, regardless of where they come from or their background, people hate traffic. Biking, and all the data points in this direction, the more people who bike, the fewer cars there are on the road, the less traffic there is. And yet, every time you build a bike lane to that will increase ridership and take cars off the road, people will immediately say that it causes traffic.
Because it's restricting the lanes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really interesting, you know, and I think it's only going to get more challenging, because at this point, the way information flows to people is that in a lot of ways, and I don't envy anyone that has to work in the media, we are post-fact. And it's really hard to convince people that there's this thing called facts and data, and that they teach us the right way to head and the direction that we need to go in. And when that flies in the face of what they anecdotally experience or know, then that's really hard to change people's perspectives. But I also think that it's possible. So I think that our work is only strengthened when we have to sharpen our tactics against polarization.
I don't know if this is so much a question, but it does kind of seem like a chicken or the egg scenario to me sometimes when I read this criticism, because drivers may be against bike lanes because it's, you know, making fewer lanes to drive on. But the reason they're driving in the first place is because maybe those bike lanes don't exist in the first place. There's not an option for safe biking. So, I mean, how much do you come up against that kind of thing in your work?
Pretty much every day. So we know that there is a significant portion of the population that lives within 2 to 3 miles of their workplace that chooses to get in their car and drive by themselves. And we also know that of the people that do that, there's a significant portion that would totally bike if it was safer and more comfortable. So we're on this mission to create options for those people that are interested in biking, but they have their reservations. The goal of my work and the work of Bike More is not to make everybody give up their cars and ride a bike. I think there are people that work in bike advocacy who see that as their mission, and I worry about that tack, because I think it removes the efficacy and choice that I believe human beings should get to have both their, you know, their own agency over their life. What I want to do, and what I think the work of Bike More is doing, is saying there is a way to reimagine how we design public space. And when we redesign public space in a way that prioritizes people, the safety of people, the health of people, the quality of life of the people that live in Baltimore City over automobile throughput, everybody wins, even the people that decide to stay in their car and drive by themselves. And we just know that when you change the way a city is designed, not only are you reducing the amount of people that are injured or killed by traffic crashes, but you also improve the public health of everyone that lives in your city. You do that by improving air quality. You do that by increasing access to cardiovascular activity. And we also know that you make a place somewhere that people don't want to just drive through, but they want to inhabit. And I think that that's ultimately, no matter what the challenges that Baltimore is facing, that has been our crux, right? We have made policy decisions based on the people. I read something today, Downtown Partnership published a report that only 30% of the people that work downtown actually live in the city. Why is that? And why do people that live in the city have to go outside of the city to find work? Why is there such a mismatch? And what can we do to make sure that every neighborhood has assets and opportunities that make people want to live there and work there?
Going back to talking about hyper-segregated cities, one of the main critiques of some of these bike lanes and the bike shares is that they have been concentrated in the predominantly white mm-hmm. neighborhoods of Baltimore, and that the predominantly black neighborhoods have been neglected. Why is that the case, and how are you going to address that?
So the why is complicated, but also simple. And it's basically that you're looking, so let's talk about bike share. So bike share is a tool that only works when the stations are sited close together. So this idea that the density of how the stations are sited, that has to exist in order for the system to be successful as a whole. So it wouldn't necessarily mean that they have to be concentrated in one neighborhood over another, but it just means that they have to be concentrated in some place in the city. So then you think about, well, why did they decide downtown? And the reason for that is that they made the decision to put stations in places where they would attract an initial surge of ridership that would financially sustain the system in terms of interest, and then also station sponsorship. So you have 12 of the existing 22 stations in the ground that some business paid to have installed. So this idea of cost sharing, and that the city itself has made a choice to have the economic model of bike share rely on corporate sponsorship. Corporate sponsorship is going to be concentrated where corporate interests are. Why are corporate interests concentrated in certain parts of the city and not others? Well, that's because of decades of structurally racist planning decisions that concentrated wealth in certain areas and not others. And so it doesn't matter what you do. If you use the same planning principles, you're going to overlay things and things are going to continue to be concentrated in the same areas. What we're talking about at Bikemore is, how do you disrupt the planning principles? And that is why we were so involved in the recent passage of Transform Baltimore, which is the city's first zoning rewrite in nearly 30 years. And what was interesting about the zoning rewrite was that towards the end, when all of these amendments started to get introduced, that ultimately decided where certain businesses can go, like where they can receive licenses, what buildings can be used for certain purposes. I have to tell you, I was really disappointed with who was at the table at the end. And it was really disheartening that at various points in the process, and it was a long, arduous, and drawn out process, and that I would say different people in the advocacy community have been engaged at different phases. But at the end, when these amendments were being passed, we were one of the only non-lobbying interests there, asking hard questions that had to do with things like racial equity, that had to do with things like making sure that all neighborhoods had the advantage of a zoning overlay that would encourage mixed-use development so that other neighborhoods stood a chance of having restaurants and dry cleaners and coffee shops and things that people need to make high-quality neighborhoods exist and small businesses exist that create jobs, that make it so not so challenging to live in certain neighborhoods. So that's one way that we're working to undo some of these planning principles that continue to have this happen. But then the other part is that as a city, we have to quit simplifying the narrative of our city as black and white, and that it's not about eliminating talking about race as a deciding point. It's absolutely that has to be at the forefront. We are a majority of black city. We have this history of disenfranchisement. We must think creatively about how to build up the assets and wealth and leadership that is coming from our neighborhoods, that they have ideas and solutions. And how do we get those funded? How do we champion them? How do we get the resources and assets that people are asking for? The other piece is biking means different things in different communities, and that it is shallow to think that just placing a bike share station or a bike lane in a community is going to invite ridership without also being thoughtful and diligent about addressing the real public safety issues that impact our neighborhoods and absolutely disproportionately impact our neighborhoods of color. And to choose to invite people to walk and bike more or to wait at a bus stop more in neighborhoods where being vulnerable has real consequences, and without investing in the things that make streets safer. And I say, and safety means so many different things in different neighborhoods in Baltimore. So without unpacking those conversations and having them with all of the right people at the table, having input into what those solutions are, yeah, we're going to keep repeating the same mistakes. And so, you know, one of our goals as an organization is to make sure that the folks in neighborhoods that want to have influence on the transportation and land use decisions that are happening in their neighborhood, they have access to the resources, whether those are educational resources or financial resources or political resources, to be able to do that work. And that's really going to be the central focus of our organizational's work moving forward, is to capacity build and make sure that we demystify the discussion around transportation and land use in this city so that everybody feels like they have something to offer and they have insight to provide.
Liz Cornish, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Liz Cornish, Executive Director of Bikemore. You can subscribe to Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. All our past episodes and more information is also available at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Feel free to follow us and send us a tweet at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist, who was the first guest on this podcast. We'll be back on Tuesday with a new episode. Thanks again.